not taken that decisive step regards to the decision-making process, right? For him, the decision-making process is taken out of the hands of humans and is all conducted along the lines of the technocracy movement and is all decided for you, you know, beforehand. You know, you take what you need from the supplies that are available, right, and deal with them as you so wish, right? That's at an individual level, you know. The social level, you know, the decision-making process becomes far more prominent because then what comes into focus is the democratic structure of the decision-making process, which is not discussed whatsoever by Peter Joseph and never has been discussed. He's not into democracy, Peter Joseph. Neither was Fresco. Right. Indeed, they're of the opinion, Peter Joseph is still of the opinion. Fresco's been dead a few years now, but he was also of the same opinion, right? That, in fact, you know, counter distinction, the democratic structure promotes opinions. It does not promote facts. Right? They only deal with facts. What is possible? What is possible under technology and with technology? Therefore, you know, it fails because our social structure, whatever social structure we're living in, requires opinion. Right? It doesn't always require facts. Because without the subjective content, we don't get very far. You know, we'll only be dealing with the objective content. The two have got to go together. That's enough.
Okay, Joel?
Hi, Adam.
Yeah, you're on.
Yeah, just a simple question, Adam. Has Peter Joseph and his people gone on the same lines as him? Have they heard of the World Socialist Movement?
I think we have tried to make contact. I think he probably has heard of it, but he doesn't want to be associated with the word socialism. For reasons which we can partly understand, of course, that socialism means Russia, but it also means a reformism. So he steers clear of that, even though the objective of a moneyless world of abundance is the same, and we've had debates in when Zeitgeist was a large movement. We think it's not so large nowadays, and we discussed this thing. But you know, Brian's point is valid to a certain extent. Yeah. Anyway, does that satisfy you, Joel?
Yeah, I mean, it's like Brian said, he's not, and people along the same lines, and he's not willing to take that next step. Obviously, some of the things he was saying are certainly fascinating, and that book, is it from 1863? I mean, it's like, yeah, that's quite something as well. But thank you. Thank you for the evening.
It was 1833, actually, so it's even... Anyway, Mark.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of a bit annoyed, to be honest. I'm just wondering, where is the anti-capitalism in all this? And it's very intellectual, but I can't imagine anybody... I mean, I had trouble understanding it, to be honest. I'll be quite honest. It's like a highly intellectual, technocratical, but I don't see that as aligning with us at all, to be honest. So, I mean, I don't complain that it's been put out, but I'm just wondering. It's almost like a caricature. I don't know. Does anybody agree? I mean, I found myself wondering what was going on during that that talk.
Let me read you Peter Joseph's definition of capitalism. This is it now. Quote, a social system based on property, exchange, labor for income, competitive self-regulation, and the capacity to profit from scarcity and deprivation, end quote. So that's his definition of capital, the definition of capitalism he's come to since he first brought out that that film. But I think, there are some interesting points that they make. But as I say, he's coming from a different direction from us. You know, he doesn't see this society being established by the action of the working class, and he doesn't claim to be a socialist. He comes from, as we've discussed, the technocratic movement, which tends to think that, I think as has been pointed out, the technocrats work out what people need for a healthy life, and then they arrange for it to be produced as efficiently as possible. There have been people who've taken up that position. But I think it's an interesting counter to some of the other ideas which are expressed in the socialist movement, like William Morris going back to handicrafts and things. Anyway, Dougie.
It reminded me of a book I read years ago, just a science fiction book, Stainless Steel Rat Gets Drafted. It goes to this world where they always had war and famine and disease. They were always fighting each other. They've decided to see if a computer could sort it out, right? So they told the computer what's the best way to run society. And of course, the computer ended up with a communist type society or whatever. They seem to be coming from a technocratic view, and they don't have any idea about working class people emancipating themselves, right? You know, it's all about, you know, the computers and, you know, the technocrats will sort things out. And I can't see that mechanism working in a capitalist society. I mean, you've got all these billionaires. They're not going to give up to the technocrats, but the working class can dispossess them. But I can't see how. I mean, he was very good at describing some of the stuff that goes on in capitalism. You know, the stuff being wasted and stuff like that, right? You know, and he's good at describing capitalism, but I don't think he's got the mechanism for changing it, right?
Right, Darren.
Hi. Just a question about the book that he was talking about from the 1830s. Are you just wondering if anybody in the meeting was actually priorly aware of the book, what their opinion is of the book, you know, its history, and also perhaps why he picked that book? Because I know it's not the exact same, but there is a history of utopian literature which has spoken of like a, you know, post-scarcity society, if you like, or a, you know, a non-monetary society. And it goes back a lot longer than the 1800s. You know, I'd recommend to people listening the book Journey Through Utopia from Marie-Louise Bernerai from the 1940s, which was it's in print now. And, it, you know, she wrote about, you know, Campanelli and Francis Bacon and Thomas More, Big Rock Candy Mountain, et cetera, you know, there's lots of examples of, you know, like post-scarcity societies. And I'm just curious why he picked this one from the 1830s, one that I was never previously aware of. And I'm kind of wondering if it is, kind of ties in with what Brian suggested and others have suggested, is that he's almost like picked the depoliticized text because he doesn't want this association with like socialism or radical movements. And he does want, it's almost like, yeah, isn't this just a good idea? This is just the next step in society. And if we get enough eggheads together to actually propose it, you know, if Elon Musk tweeted, you know, resource-based economy on his Twitter account, would this kind of galvanize the, you know, like the technocrats to kind of sort of move towards us? So I'm just curious, you know, is this just him trying to sort of, you know, propose like a defanged, you know, D-class struggled like argument for like, you know, what we would consider a socialist society, you know. Thank you.
Actually, I think that's a bit unfair to, if you read the review of his book, The New Human Rights Movement, he does envisage this society established by some form of mass action, by grassroots action. I don't think he, I mean, said in that he disagrees with all these people who think that somehow capitalism will automatically evolve into society. He definitely, I mean, the actual series of talks are called Revolution. So he I don't think he thinks that socialism will come about. A society of abundance will come about automatically without some sort of mass action. Anyway, Nick.
Thanks, Adam. That was a very, very interesting speech, and thanks for coming to the rescue, bailing it out. That was very good. I didn't know much about, I hadn't really heard of this guy, Peter Joseph. Very interesting, and this technocracy movement. It's quite interesting, though. A lot of the ideas that he was talking about, I'm sure he's borrowed from Murray Bookchin. I mean, Bookchin wrote a book called Post-Scarcity Anarchism, which talked about a lot of the ideas that he presented. And that was published in 1968, some time ago. It argued the same kind of logic, you know, against the application of Darwinism, you know, and the cult of trying to map Darwinism onto social theory. That was certainly argued a lot by Bookchin and many others. There were interesting things there he didn't mention. I didn't notice him mention anything about patents, which is the stalwart of capitalism. I would have thought that would have featured in his argument. Maybe I just missed that. And also, he kind of was going to talk about the commodity fetishism, as Marx mentioned in Capital, but didn't really expand too much on that. In fact, he almost didn't want to get into that conversation, which is maybe I'm reading something into that. But overall, it was very interesting. I didn't catch the name of the book that was published in 1830. Perhaps you could put that on the somewhere on the general chat or useful links, and also. You know, if you've got a useful link to a PDF of his book, that would be interesting because it's a bit expensive on the looking at it on Amazon. Just one thing that I would say is a bit of advertising, but I've built my made a lot of progress on building my website on Bookchin. It's a library, and I'll put a link in there to a PDF of Bookchin's book that was published in. Called Post-Scarcity Anarchism. So if anybody wants to go and have a look at my website and and have a look what's there, but you can download that in a PDF form from the link on the website. I'll put that in the chat. Okay, I'll let Carla go ahead.
I put the book, the reference to the book in the link. I think... talk about Bookchin's nearest book would be the call towards liberatory technology. Anyway, next speaker is Mike Brown, I think.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. That was an interesting talk. I noticed he's got 11. That's number 11, and there's a 13 on your screen that you had up. So I don't think you can judge him by just one talk on a very complex subject. He spoke very fast, so I didn't catch everything he said. He seemed to know what he was talking about. And I would imagine if you put all the 13, he's probably got more sense, and listen to them all, most of those questions that were asked by Joel, Mark, Dougie, Darren, Nick, would be answered. He does seem to know what we're talking about. He does seem to have worked out what's wrong with a lot of the ideas, not only in capitalism, but in the people who are trying to change it by technology. And quite interesting. It'd be a pity he's not a party member because he would be really nice to have all those lectures and study them. That's what we need to do, I think. This person does know what he's talking about. He speaks very fast. It's not possible to catch everything. thanks for that. You know, he doesn't know what he's talking about, this guy. Worth studying more, I think. What do you think?
Yeah, he does have a fortnightly podcast. That was number 11. So he's reached number 20 now. But one of the things that the Zeitgeist movement tried to do was to get together scientists and other experts to do a world survey to find out could produce enough remote and what would be involved in this. So it's probably premature, but at some stage I think we have something like that happening as well. There's nobody else in the queue except for Carla's name is there. Did you want to say something?
Yes, please. I've got a queue okay. there.
You're
Well, actually, similar to Mike, really. It's very difficult to base it on just the one podcast, but I do know a little bit about Peter Joseph, and he's a bit like Zizek. He has a very clear understanding of capitalism, and obviously he doesn't like it, but he doesn't seem to tell us any more. He doesn't seem to give us a way out of it, and it kind of stops there, like Zizek does. He tells us all about it, and it's the, you know, blah, 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 but never, ever gives us an alternative or gives us any ideas. So I think that's a bit disappointing, really. And, yeah, he's typically American, you know. He just uses a lot of words and a lot of technical stuff. But, I mean, I understood it okay. But, as I say, he just has a very clear understanding, and it's interesting. But we all know about obsolescence. We've been talking about it for years in the party. So stuff like this we already know. Yeah, that's basically all I wanted to say. Thank you.
I'm not sure it's a compliment to be compared to Zizek. Anyway, Joy's on next.
Yeah. Hi, Adam. It's actually Howard here, not Joy.
It's still a Joy.
It's okay. It's Joy's computer, but it's Howard. All right.
Yes, I can tell it's Howard. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. just to say, yes, certainly don't compare him with Zizek, who is an absolute shit peddler. I mean, this bloke, to a large extent, knows what he's talking about. I mean, the party has discussed, as Brian will tell you, has discussed the Zeitgeist movement in the past, of which he's one of the prime proponents. And they are very close to us, there's no doubt about it, in all sorts of ways, in far more ways, for example, than the conventional left. I mean, the conventional left never talks about a moneyless society of abundance, for example. This chap does, the Zeitgeist movement does. So, and as one or two other people have said, a bit unfair to judge him just from this one podcast. Interesting though it was. I mean, you know, if you listen to I've listened to a few of the others, and there's a lot on them that we definitely agree with. He obviously doesn't want to be connected with politics. You know, he almost studiedly didn't mention Marx, for example, when talking about 19th century thinkers. He talked about this sort of eccentric individual who actually sounds quite interesting, nevertheless. So I think, you know, he's somebody who's it's worth our getting to know, even if he, as it seems to be the case, even if he doesn't want to know us. You know, it's good that there are people with ideas that are quite similar to us knocking around, you know, they're doing their best to spread them.
Okay, thanks. Darren, again.
Just very quickly, I found the text of the 1833 book, and I've put a link to it in Useful Links. Adam actually got the guy's surname wrong, you know, that's okay. But it's in Useful Links, and he's also got a wiki page, but I didn't put the link for the wiki page. Thank you.
Thanks. Right, Paul.
Yeah, that was good. I must admit, I thoroughly enjoyed these kind of each type of presentations, Adam. It was a good one to come across and share with us. I enjoyed it to the sense or to the extent that the guy's obviously a smart enough man, but clever, articulate, and everything else, but I'm inclined. But the only way I can really describe it, I don't mean to sound sort of crude here, but it's a bit, you know, when you're sort of getting intimate and you're getting to the point of no return, and then something just comes along, sort of pulls the rug from under your feet, you know. He's just not quite taking us to the promised land almost, you know. And I don't know how deliberate that is, if he's just lacking imagination or whatever, but he just didn't seem to quite hit the mark, although he was certainly well on the way to it. Not the most accurate of definitions, but, you know, I started getting sort of quite excited as he was speaking, then suddenly I felt terribly let down, because it was almost as though you could definitely identify, or certainly he could certainly identify, it was almost like he was plagiarising the Socialist Party by some of the things he was talking about, and then suddenly it all went pear-shaped and tits up. But, you know, I mean, certainly it was very good. I think one of the other things that I gleaned from it is again, just how good and important and relevant these podcasts are, and, you know, having the idea of having an additional audio visual kind of presence on the website. I mean, obviously we've got Paddy's terrific Capitalists and Other Kids stuff things, and that will always stand the test of time, although it's a bit dated now. It's nice to see the younger version of Paddy, obviously, and so on, but I think that's something we really need to try and capture, and that is, you know, is having these podcasts, video cast, well, podcasts are terrific, with you know, maybe a couple of three or half a dozen of us coming together to produce an audio link that people can click on in order to produce and promote and propagate the party case as articulately as he did what he was standing for. I think that's certainly something we really need to try and, dare I say, capitalise on. Just my thoughts on the overall subject. But it was very, very good. And as I say, I personally like these kind of evenings where, you know, so instead of one person putting in a shitload of work and everything that's involved with it, great as that is, and that'll never stop. But it's nice just for everyone to be able to sit back, relax, listen, and then chip in like this. So the actual format I thought was absolutely terrific. Thanks for finding that, guys. That was really interesting. Thank you. Cheers.
Okay, thanks. But all these technical things don't always work on. Anyway, Paddy, you're on now.
Hi, sorry everybody for that disaster before. My computer just completely crashed. I had the blue screen of death even, so it was pretty serious. Anyway, you managed to sort it out with Adam, so that was good. I listened to this as well. I kept losing the thread, I found. I just thought, it doesn't half go on. Because I thought being verbose was a bit of an SBGB trait, but he's much worse. I think it's because he doesn't have anyone to tell him when to shut up. I was one of the people who, when the whole Zeitgeist thing started, I got, you know, like a lot of people, I got very excited about it. I thought, oh, here's a guy who's going to sort of kickstart the revolution. But after all these years, I just wonder who it is that he's talking to. I mean, I'm on the Zeitgeist Discord server. I think a few people here are, and anybody who is can just go and hover over it right now and see that there's nobody in it. And they've got loads, they've got hundreds of channels. It looks really impressive, but very often, you know, every day pretty much, I look at it and there's nobody on it. You know, and at the height of Zeitgeist, there was something like, I don't know, 400,000, half a million members, or not members, but I don't know, subscribers, people who signed up to the email or something like that. And, you know, where have they all gone? I'm not saying this to sort of laugh at Peter Joseph at all, not at all. I think, you know, he's done some really good stuff. And in fact, I think he's moved more in our direction over the years, and certainly away from that sort of, you know, there's some of those conspiracy theory things that he had. But where's it all gone? You know, people seem to have drifted off. And despite this, you would think that, you know, given this sort of, you know, sort of shrinking in support or interest, that he would maybe start to reach out to people, to groups and things that were like him. But absolutely not. I was in a correspondence with him quite recently when he just absolutely, you know, flatly refused to have anything to do with us. Quite, he was polite, but, you know, no dice. And, you know, it's because he just wants to dissociate from all the sources that he got his ideas from, it seems to me. And, you know, he just thinks he can go it alone. But the evidence of the, if the Zeitgeist Discord server is anything to go by, you know, that's just not happening. He seems to be sort of preaching to an empty gallery these days, sadly. And he still insists on being king of his own hill. You know, and I think this sort of really does speak to a kind of lack of of a democratic concept within his theory. He just doesn't regard that as an important part of the process, and yet people have just drifted away. I suppose because all you could do as a Zeitgeist supporter was just sit and lap up the pearls of wisdom that fell from his lips. You know, there wasn't really anything else. You know, there wasn't any sort of decision making that he did. I don't know. I wasn't sort of involved in it, but that does seem to me a sort of a pretty fundamental problem with the Zeitgeist approach. So I think it's quite sad, really. And, you know, his ideas are really good, and he's done a phenomenal amount of work over the years. But I just don't think Zeitgeist is going to make us redundant anytime soon. So, you know, I'm afraid we can't sit back and, you know, let Peter Joseph do it for us, because that's not going to happen.
Right, Paul again.
Yeah, just to say, I mean, that's where I think his underlying fault is. He's got a lot of echo there. Okay, carry on. Yeah. So, and I think this is where his underlying problem is. He's just not taking. It's almost like he likes the sound of his own voice. It's almost like a preach, like a lesson, rather than focusing on taking people with him. You know, I think that's one of our strengths, is that we are, you know, we understand and the absolute importance of joined up working and thinking, cooperation and moving forward together. As a movement, you know, you could tell he seemed very much like the educator, and obviously we all have to learn, but there it stops. It's just like he was failing to, in that all too important technique of bringing it. And it's a bit what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, an act of leadership where you're not dictating to people what they should think, how they should think, how they should do things. It's more to do with pulling together ideas and moving forward as one unit rather than one person telling everyone how and what they should be thinking. And I think that was probably the ideas are terrific. His human interaction skills seem to be what's letting him down, and obviously that reflects on, as Paddy says, why people maybe deserted him, because, you know, again, going back to that sort of analogy of taking people to certain heights, to dizzy heights, and then suddenly, you know, you reach a dead end and there's nothing to show for it kind of thing. That's my take on where he might have gone a little bit wrong in his journey.
Actually, the right guy saw the opposite course to us. When, you know, they just admit anybody. And what Peter Joseph found, of course, he was swamped by people with lots of currency crank ideas and conspiracy. And in the end, he shut down the thing, which it never could be democratic if it had been outvoted. But anyway, Brian has experience of the Zeitgeist movement, so perhaps you can tell us more, Brian.
Yes, Adam. What was notable about Peter Joseph and his cohorts within the Zeitgeist movement is that they continually spoke at their audience, like supporters. There are no members, or were no members within the Zeitgeist movement, as someone else has pointed out. Like, there was just supporters. You supported the Zeitgeist movement from whichever angle you favoured, and, you know, which fitted within your focus of society as a whole, like, you know. But back to what Paul brought up, you know, in regards to his relationship, right? with people, yes. And like I said, he's him and his cohorts, and that's people within the structure. And it was a hierarchical structure, always a hierarchical structure within the Zeitgeist movement. Who's at the top? It could be Peter Joseph, it could be somebody else, but it's certainly a hierarchy. And this was notable in regards to who belonged to the hierarchy and how they came within the hierarchy. And what they employed was a slate system of favorites with people within the hierarchy, including Peter Joseph and the global coordinator, we'll call it Gilbert. That was it, yeah. If you were, you know, their favorites, you know, you was invited to become a member of the slate and put on the slate and so forth. You know, no voting whatsoever, right? There was no voting what took place whatsoever. It was a system of consensus. But, you know, what I found amazing was that the consensus was agreed before even it was, you know, put on the agenda, you know. What it was to be. Yeah, so certainly, Paul, it's a lesson, you know, that podcast is a lesson on speaking at your audience instead of speaking with your audience, right? And when it comes to the working class, you certainly need to speak with them, not at them, because then it turns out just to be a purely a lecture, and it's do this, do that, blah, 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 all the way down the road, which is what the technocrats want, anyway. Thank you.
Yeah, just if I can just respond to that, and I can agree with you more, Brian. That's precise. I couldn't have put it better myself. That is a perfect analogy of what he's done. More about talking at you rather than with you. So that was a really good description. Thanks for that.
But it's the Zeitgeist movement was inevitably undemocratic. Didn't agree with it. They had to be a clique, which, as I say, was the opposite to what we do. We only admit people who fully agree with us. But there are other interesting breakaways from the Zeitgeist movement. I mean, there's a party called the Money Free Party in this country. Money Free, New Zealand, and other parts of the world, which haven't got the same technocratic background and approach as the original Zeitgeist, but they exist. I mean, obviously, we've got other criticism of them because they don't see action, but they do at least see it becoming not through political action. Anyway, Nick, you want to come back again?
Yeah, I'm just. It's kind of it was very interesting listening to this guy, Peter Joseph, is it? Yeah. It seems to me to raise more questions than answers, really. I mean, perhaps Adam, you or Brian can reveal some, catch some light on his actual motivation, because I find it hard to work out what his motivations are. It's very much a criticism with capitalism, and very very accurate and well argued. But there doesn't seem to be any direction. And as others have said, there's no mention of democracy, or there's no kind of route to utopia. And he doesn't actually take on the reaction to the capitalists by, you know, should they follow this route? There'd be I don't think he really addressed that. But it's only the one podcast, so maybe he does it argues that out in other literature, etc. But my main question there is, what is his motivation? Thanks.
Well, he's a filmmaker. Similar, he would want to change. He'd want to change society. I think it is unfair to podcast. I mean, in his book, he talks about class war. No, he doesn't. He sees the rich waging a class war on the poor, which I suppose one way of looking at it, rather than us waging a class war on the rich. But there's you need to the podcast. I mean, there's one which we could broadcast here about human nature. Well, he's reinventing.
You keep breaking up, Adam.
You keep what?
You keep breaking up.
Okay.
Try speaking more slowly.
Well, again, Howard.
Just wanted to sort of reiterate some of the things people have said. You and Paddy and Brian and one or two others that this was a movement, the Zeitgeist movement, that seemed to sort of take off a few years ago and to have thousands and thousands of adherents throughout the world. You saw news of their events all over the place. You thought, God, this is something new, something dramatic. And at one point, just tell this little story, there was an event that took place in a city 40 miles away from me, Cardiff, that I went to with Brian. It was a film, a Zeitgeist film was being shown, and it was being shown in the top floor of this sort of bar. It was a big room and it was absolutely jam-packed. Probably 100 to 150 people there anyway. I got the shock of my life, especially when I started to watch the film, which quite honestly, there was nothing in that we could really object to. It was a really good sort of characterization of capitalism and how we could have a different kind of society, etc. It was a very long film, and there was a break after an hour and a half, believe it or not, Jeez. For people to go and get drinks. I thought, right, everyone's going to drift away now. We reconvened 20 minutes later, and everybody came back. Absolutely phenomenal. In fact, I had to leave before the end because I had to get back to Swansea. But I remember during the break, I chatted to sort of one or two of the people there who'd come. Quite a few of them were students, I suppose. And to be honest, they didn't seem to have any real idea what, although they'd been attracted by the sort of, by the organisation, they seemed to have a great deal of idea what it was about. Some of the things they were saying, you know, we definitely wouldn't agree with in any shape or form. It was an organisation that proved for a time very, very attractive, but now seems to sort of, As I think Ms. Paddy was saying, look at their Discord platform, more or less faded away, apart from Peter Joseph himself and maybe one or two others.
A lot of things, though, couldn't you?
It's a bit unfortunate, really, because, if there are other organisations saying similar things to us around and attracting a lot of attention, I think it's all the better for the socialist idea.
Okay, Paddy, sorry. So, Paddy...
Yeah, no, that's fine. I just had the sort of it just occurred to me, this whole technocracy thing. I wonder if, I mean, this goes back to Plato, actually. I think originally Plato's Republic and the rule of the wise, the rule of the philosophers. Interestingly, in Plato's Republic, though, the philosophers get to rule, but they're not allowed to own anything. They're not allowed to own any wealth. And the workers don't get to rule, but they are allowed to own wealth, although not too much wealth. So kind of interesting. But so this idea of, the sort of wise elite is incredibly old. Not saying that's what Peter Joseph thinks, but it's one of the roots, I think. But I was going to actually ask another question, going back to the original subject, because we haven't really talked about it, is post-scarcity, what we think about that now. Because now, I remember years ago in the party, we always used to seem to talk about abundance, post-scarcity abundance. And now it seems to me what we tend to talk about is post-scarcity sufficiency. If I'm right, perhaps we've kind of lowered our collective sights a little bit. Maybe we've, decided that abundance maybe seems a bit unrealistic. But at the same time, you've got this other organisation, Fully Automated Luxury Communism, who've gone the other way. The clue's in the name. They're claiming a communist society that's fully automated and provides luxuries for everybody. I'm just wondering what members think about this. You know, are we being too modest? Are we being too unambitious? Or are they being too overweening? And which one workers are more likely to go for, do we think? So it's just a question I thought I'd throw in.
Okay, Brian, what do you think of that?
Well, myself personally, you know, I'm not after full luxury communism, no way at all. You know, I just want the access, is all. The access will be fine. But I put up the question anyway in regards to, I think it was Paul, I'm not sure. Or was it Nick? It might have been Nick, I'm not sure. Anybody who's querying motivation for Peter Joseph, right? As far as I could see, when I was in the Zeitgeist movement, his motivation was purely to do with the inefficiency of capitalism, both in the realms of production and distribution, right? He was really up against that. And seeing the requirement for a world survey, which he was very keen about. Oh, and that one period, he offered myself and a further supporter of the Zeitgeist movement, Dick, who's a Portuguese living in South America, to set up this world survey. So we both turned it down because we knew that the world survey would come under the criteria of Peter Joseph, what he considered to be a world survey, etc. Me and Nick, we were both aware, like, you know, that any production and distribution would take the voluntary effort of the producers, the associated producers at that time. Oh, and it would be a classless society. That's what his motivation was. It was the inefficiency of the system itself, right? Both in a production sense and also in a distribution sense. But this is not to say that he also, as he points out in the talk, right, points out that capitalism has produced this abundance, but it can't deal with it, except in an inefficient manner.
Okay, Joel?
I get the impression from people that, I don't know if it's wrong, but without Peter Joseph saying it, he seems to have a distrust of the working class with him coming from this sort of technological angle. I mean, am I reading it wrong, or is that...
A quick answer, Joel. You're not reading it wrong. Totally correct. That was Peter Joseph's way all along.
Thank you, Brian. That's all I wanted to ask. Thank you.
Okay. Mark.
Yeah, well, I'm just responding sort of instinctively to what Paddy said about, you know, whether, you know, like he said, whether the party has lowered its standard from, you know, abundance to sufficiency. But you know, I just have that, it's the same issue that my initial response to what Peter Joseph said, which was, you know, like, where was the anti-capitalism in the sense of that spirit of, well, rebellion, you know, rejection of the of what is, what I think, you know, my understanding of what socialism is first and foremost is we're talking about the rejection of oppression, we're talking about liberation, we're talking about we're talking about a world where people are free. And as far as I can, my own feeling is that in that world of freedom, which means when capitalist oppression is overthrown, there's going to be all sorts of things happening. And I can imagine we could have all sorts of, you know, as it were, you know, putting it colloquially, shit happening. And it's not about, you know, standard of living per se. It's about freedom from oppression. And I don't know, I got from Peter Joseph's talk, well, frankly, I didn't get very much. I mean, maybe I wasn't maybe, you know, it's obviously possible that one, I was listening with a kind of a, let's say, a cynical ear, but I didn't get that spirit of rebellion, that spirit of rejection, and we're going to overthrow the system, and we need to implement a system that works for everyone, which means first and foremost what we call the working class, but actually for everybody. It's like just a way of distributing wealth. I just don't, personally, I don't buy that approach. And I don't actually buy that oppressed people, which means actually the working class and all parts of the working class who are oppressed, will respond to that. We're not really interested in how best to distribute goods and services within society. We're interested in overthrowing oppression. And I don't think we want to lose that in various. I mean, I know we need to talk about various issues, but the spirit of it is the rejection of what is, and not just about, you know, various ideal ways of. You know, we're not talking just about Star Trek. I mean, we can talk about it, but it's not what drives. At least, maybe I'm just talking personally. It's not what drives me. What drives me is, you know, gay people who get beaten up on the street. That's what drives me. It drives me, and actually what also drives me is animals that get killed. What drives me is inequality and injustice, and we fight against it. And the world that comes next, well, we deal with it. We deal with whatever comes next, because there's going to be all sorts of issues. But capitalism is the currently dominating system that holds us down. And I think that needs to, or at least that's how I feel it. So somehow I feel a little bit of a disconnect with the discussion.
Okay. Joel, you wanted to come back?
No, that was a mistake. Sorry.
Mistake. Okay. Paul, you're coming back.
Yes, Simon, I promise I'll make this the last for tonight. I'm a great believer in simplicity is genius. All these kind of buzzwords about post scarcity and abundance. Of course, they're important. Of course, most people who have half an idea of what we as a party stand for will understand those terms and what they mean. And some of that, I mean, you know, it's given examples before about you know, all these kind of offshoots of anarchism. As I was saying, a lot of these buzzwords I think can be very off-putting for a lot of people, you know, as if it's not difficult enough to wrap your head around the idea of a world without money when it's all that you've ever been used to. I prefer to approach these things by describing how human beings will live in a world where our needs are met. You know, our basic human needs are met, and then we can start to build on it from there. Now, that doesn't, sometimes that can invoke ideas of, and quite often you get the response of, oh, don't want to go back to the cavemen and shite like that, you know, and that's, it's quite a silly kind of attitude. But I think rather than complicate and confuse things, you stick to that basic principle and that basic sort of modicum of understanding that what we're looking for is to be able to live and enjoy a reasonable standard and quality of life where your needs are being met. And then once we've managed to solve that, we can start to build on it thereafter. Because as soon as you start sort of sowing these ideas about how we're all going to potentially have yachts and fast cars and living in yachts and things, then you're straight away, you know, you're in a hiding to nothing. Nobody realistically believes that. At the same time, you don't want people to think that they're going to be worse off within socialism than they are under capitalism. But that's my approach to these things. Keep it simple. Keep the message simple. I'm not saying the working class are stupid. Far from it. We're all very clever and thoughtful people, so long as the ideas that are being presented are understandable and clear, whatever level of intellect you have. The important thing is to keep the message simple, straightforward and understandable, rather than use silly buzzwords and such like. Yes.
Thanks. Funny you should mention the caveman, because maybe Darren will be able to tell us more about this, the section of the American Party which became primitivists, who are known as the caveman tendency. Anyway, Carla.
I just thought Paddy talking about going from abundance to sufficiency and have we lowered our standards. And I'm thinking, well, you know, we will inherit a world that has been overfished, overfarmed, a bit of a mess, really. And I think that certainly in the beginning, it will be sufficiency, but at least it will be, you know, we'll make sure that the people who are starving are fed and we will have a fairly decent standard of living. But, you know, we will have a lot of problems. I mean, things are, rare now, and only the few that can afford it can have these things. So there will be some kind of, I'm not saying rationing, because that sort of sounds like coming from above, but I think we'll be sensible and be only too happy that we've got a better world. And I think that we haven't lowered our standards. I think it's just a more pragmatic approach now. I think we realise the state of the world that we're going to inherit, and we'll build it up. I'm sure this planet can provide extreme abundance, but for the time being, I think I think we'll be quite happy with sufficiency. Thank you.
Okay, Paddy.
I just thought I'd come in because nobody else seen the queue. I just wanted to agree with what Carla said, and I think that's a fundamentally reasonable position to take. And but I remember, I remember years ago, sort of arguing something like this, and sort of being accused of something called hair shirt socialism by a certain member on the editorial committee, not now present. My feeling then and still is that workers aren't going to buy a case that offers them goodies galore. You know, if we try and make out that socialism is just this kind of bonanza, when people look around at the world that we've got now, as Carla says, they're just going to reject that out of hand. And, you know, I didn't actually say we were lowering our standards. I think I said we were lowering perhaps our ambitions or we're just changing. We're just using a different term now. I think sufficiency, actually, to me, it makes better sense to talk about sufficiency and to say to workers, look, you know, let's be realistic. What is the best that we could accomplish at the moment with the world in the state it's in? You know, if we can get everybody fed and housed and reasonably safe and sort out diseases and things like that, the luxuries might be able to come in, in time. I think if we go to workers with that sort of argument, I think that the chances are that people will be more ready to listen. But I always used to think that the kind of abundance argument was just going to be met with derision, really. And I don't know what success the fully automated luxury communism people are having. I know they've got their own sort of TV / radio station, but I don't know if that's actually a movement of any sort. I don't think it is. Anyway, that's me.
The term that Peter Joseph used is sustainable abundance. But I think that the change in tone or terminology that within the party, we used to talk about a world of abundance, pamphlets call that. This would have been in the 60s when even apologists for capitalism were talking about what's happened is the rise of the ecology movement. So I think what this shows is we're not completely independent going on in the 1960s, everybody, including apologists for capitalism, whereas today, it's people don't talk like that. So we've sort of our language. Okay, Howard.
Yeah, look, we still talk about a world of abundance, and we still should. I mean, what we've always said is that socialism will be a world of abundance, but not superabundance. I think we'll sell ourselves seriously short if we say what we're looking for is a world of sufficiency. I mean, it sounds a bit dismal as a word, sufficiency. Look, I mean, it's often said there's abundance now if the goods produced were distributed in an appropriate way. I mean, there are all these, you know, these figures that show there's far, far more food produced than necessary to feed the world. It's just the system that exists that, you know, that fails to feed people. So I think we can carry on using the term abundance. I mean, we've always said, for example, I mean, I remember when I was first in the party, you talk about abundance, you talk about people having what they want. What if I wanted a rocket to go to the moon? And my response to sort of stupid questions like that was, you won't be able to have one. Simple as that. You can't have things that are unreasonable, but you can have things that are reasonable. And there's abundance in that sense. So, you know, I do think we'll be selling ourselves short if we stop using that terminology. And we are still using it. You know, it's still in our literature. And, you know, in my view, should continue to be. Mute.
Okay, Mike Foster.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, interesting evening. Yeah, I've enjoyed listening in. I suppose on the issue of using the word abundance or sufficiency, I'm maybe more tempted towards the sort of sufficiency, putting the emphasis there. And I suppose my thinking behind that is that when socialists were writing about abundance in previous decades, you know, the 60s or before, they didn't have to have the same awareness of environmental destruction than we do now. So and I think any talk of abundance would have connotations of at least on first glance, I mean, of oversaturating production and sort of, you know, devastating the environment as a consequence. Obviously we can successfully argue that a socialist mode of production wouldn't need to do that, but I think there's still that that barrier that we'd have to sort of overcome. So yeah, sufficiency. Yeah, I see what Paddy means about not lowering our ambition, but not lowering our standards, but lowering our ambition rather. And I suppose another thing that we need to take into account is that in Europe and America and, you know, Australasia and other parts, redistribution is more straightforward because there's already a lot of wealth floating around in those areas, whereas, you know, parts of Asia, Africa, I think in the early days of socialism, America and Europe won't really be as much of a priority as other parts of the world where production and distribution really need to be shaken up to a greater extent than in, you know, the developed countries. So I think, yeah, the emphasis will shift to other areas, and that's where the priorities will lie in terms of achieving sufficiency or abundance. Yeah, thank you.
Hey, I think we've had our regulatory 2 hours. Anybody else want to say anything? Ask any question, make a contribution? Yes, Carla does.
Oh, yeah, just an aside, really. People wondering what happened to the Zeitgeist movement. Well, their 12th annual Global Zeitgeist Day was supposed to have happened last year in Reykjavik, Iceland. Obviously, that ended up online. But they've got one arranged for this year, and it's in Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia. But they are free to attend, apparently. So that's what's happening with them.
Okay, thanks. Mike Brown.
Yeah, Adam, nothing's wrong with the term sustainable abundance. I agree with you. You know what you're talking about there. I was a bit disturbed there, comrades talking about what was going to happen when we get socialism. A bit of an honest question, because my question is, when will we get socialism? When will we get the people in China, in Russia, all the people in Euro-Asia, all the people in Africa, North America and South America? they'll have a say in it once we get it. But we don't have got it yet, and we've not got a chance of getting it. We're going to talk about what we're going to do when we get it. Let's get it first.
That sounds a good idea. Right. Can we bring the meeting to an end?
Cheers, Adam.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Good night, everyone.